This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. On this election day, we're going to explore an idea that dates back to ancient Greece and took root in a new world more than 2,000 years later. Today, almost every government in the world claims its legitimacy from the will of its citizens. But as important as that is, democracy is broader than politics. It's an idea that infuses works of fiction. It's closely associated with economic theory and philosophy. It affects and is affected by science and technology. So which books would we have to include in a library of democracy? As part of Public Radio's week-long coverage, which also asks the question, whose democracy is it, we need you to fill the shelves. Like a real library, we're going to have sections, fiction, economics, philosophy, children's books, and history. When we want to hear about the books that helped you understand democracy a little bit better, don't feel constrained by those categories. The staff here at Talk of the Nation is going to get things started by donating a set of democracy classics. Plato, Aristotle, Thucydides, the founding documents of the United States of America, and Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America. So what else do we need? Pick a book, just one please, tell us the title, and give us a brief explanation. Our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. The email address is totn@npr.org. At the end of this hour, we're going to take a tour of our marvelous new library to find out what we've created. And throughout this hour, guests are going to join us with some suggestions of their own, including Chinese novelist Ha Jin on fiction and futurist Ray Kurzweil on science and Eden Lipson of the New York Times on children's books. But we begin with politics. And joining us now to help us is Governor Mario Cuomo, the former governor of the state of New York. He's with us from his office in New York City. And Governor Cuomo, always good to have you on Talk of the Nation.
Thank you, and happy Election Day to you.
Thank you, too. It seems that when we got in touch with you about this, we found out we were not the first people to ask you to help define or explain democracy.
1989, actually, I was governor in Albany and was visited by a group from Poland, then recently relieved of the shackles of the Soviet Union. And they were looking for some help in terms of restoring to the Polish people the idea of democracy and helping them by suggesting sources and materials that they could use and even inviting me to come and speak. I said, well, you certainly don't need me if you have Abraham Lincoln. And I said, he is the great but neglected authority on the subject of democracy. People think of Thomas Jefferson. I think of Lincoln as being the greatest Democrat. And that led to my producing a book for them by Lincoln experts from around the United States, which described Lincoln's view of democracy in his own words. There hadn't been anything like it until the visitation from the people of Poland.
I understand that you did go ahead and create that book, which we're going to be happy to add to our library. But as I understand it, you first suggested another book and discovered...
What I suggested very glibly, I thought, was, well, Abraham Lincoln is the person surely that will be a fund of knowledge, information, and wisdom on this subject. And I will get a book by Lincoln himself, and I will have it translated into Polish and then send it to you. And they were delighted. And I went home to my residence at the mansion, satisfied with myself, until I got to my collected works of Abraham Lincoln, the Roy Basler collection, which everybody uses. All the works of Lincoln extant as of 1955. Some have been found, I understand, since then, and turned confidently to the index, looking for the word democracy. And lo and behold, it did not appear in the index, which only confirmed my fear that people had neglected Lincoln as the quintessential Democrat of our time. And that produced the need for a book. And I did get the assistance of Lincoln scholars from all over the United States, led by one who was working with me at the time, Harold Holzer, who is now a recognized scholar in the field writing. As a matter of fact, just completed a book that you'll be able to enjoy soon on the Cooper Union Address by Abraham Lincoln. But he and I put together Lincoln on Democracy, Lincoln's own words and essays on the subject of democracy. And it's an invaluable addition to any library on any set of subjects, but particularly on government, politics, and democracy.
I understand it's been translated into several languages as well.
It was translated into Polish by Milosz, who is a great Nobel Peace Prize winner, into Japanese, into Italian, into various other languages around the globe, and we were delighted. We were delighted at the success of the book, and as a matter of fact, I'm so delighted that I'm doing a second book now, which I hope will be out before the election next year, in which we attempt to bring Lincoln down to date and try to use him as we use the Bible and as we use the Founding Fathers as a source of wisdom in connection with today's problems. What would he say about preemptive strikes that produce a war? What would he say about stem cells, about religion, about any of the subjects that are intriguing, tantalizing, and troubling us at the moment?
Governor Cuomo, we're happy to accept a copy of Lincoln on Democracy by Abraham Lincoln, Mario Cuomo, editor, Patrick O'Connor, contributor, and Harold Holzer, editor for our Library of Democracy. Thanks very much for being with us today.
Thank you for having me.
And good luck with your new project.
Thank you, sir.
Governor Mario Cuomo is former governor of the state of New York. He was with us from his office in New York City. And we have some emails arriving for candidates in the realm of politics. The Rights of Man by Thomas Paine, and Advise and Consent by Alan Drury. This is a suggestion from Michael Freeman in Albany, New York. The second, he says, offers a more upbeat view of democracy and perhaps can help rekindle among the populace some of the passion for civic matters that seem to be on the decline in recent years. Of course, Drury's book, a novel, and The Rights of Man, in my recollection, is not. And here's another suggestion from in the realm of politics from S. Boy Lynn in Charlotte, North Carolina. The Public and Its Problems by John Dewey. A Theory of Justice by John Rawls. Anarchy, State, and Utopia by Robert Nozick. And Community and the Politics of Place by Daniel Camus. And here's another one from Michael Whitney in Overland Park, Kansas. I would suggest Robert Heinlein's Starship Troopers. Please disregard the movie, which has only superficial similarities. Much of the book concerns the responsibility and rights of citizens, the military, and residents of the world at large in a functioning democracy. It offers a fine reminder of the value of the vote, plus it's a great read. If you'd like to make a contribution to the Library of Democracy, our phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. Our email address is totn@npr.org. And Marcus joins us on the line from Portland, Oregon.
Hi there.
Hi.
I just wanted to suggest Animal Farm, George Orwell.
George Orwell's Animal Farm.
Mm-hmm.
And why in that one in particular?
Well, I think it teaches us. Have you read it?
I have read it. Yes.
Yeah, there's a very basic lesson in democracy for everybody there.
Okay, Marcus, thanks very much.
We're
happy to add 1984 to our Library of Democracy. Let's wander now over to the literature section, and here to help us fill those shelves is Hod Jin. He won the 1999 National Book Award for his novel Waiting and is a professor of English and creative writing at Boston University. He's with us now from his office in Boston, Massachusetts, and it's good of you to be with us.
Thank you.
Mario Cuomo talked about the Solidarity Movement in Poland in the late 1980s. China is a country struggling right now with the idea of democracy. As someone who comes from a place where democracy cannot be taken for granted, what books would you suggest to help understand it from your perspective?
It is a huge problem in the case of China. And, I've been writing several books, novels on this. All my novels have... I would say a streak of theme about this subject. For instance, my recent book, The Crazed, is about how human beings are reduced to parts of a machine, revolutionary machine. But I don't think my books are political. In a way, I agree with... I think I would make the same suggestion as Mark, the previous caller. Animal Farm.
And I'm corrected, it was Animal Farm, not 1984.
Yeah, Animal Farm. And in fact, I think it is a book that stands out in the tradition of dystopian literature. We have Zamatin's We and The Brave World and 1984.
Mm-hmm.
But in a way, all these books somehow are old-fashioned. I think Animal Farm really is unique. In a way, it is not just a anti-communist book. It is a book that always reminds us the downside of the ideal that can be changed, eroded, sometimes transformed into to make it suitable for personal needs. So I think that is a very important book. For me, also, it's a family book. When I was a student in China and I heard my teachers talk about this book at conferences, but nobody could read the original text, so we didn't know. We all heard that the book was terrifying, but we didn't know how. And later, when I became a graduate student, I read this book, and there was a moment of enlightenment and became my favorite. And later, my wife, when her English was good enough, she read the book, and the immediate response was that Orwell was a genius, and we could easily find counterpart in our everyday reality, find, you know, counterpart characters in real life. And then my son read this book when he came to the States, and really it became his favorite. That's why, for me, it's a very personal book. And I think it's also a children's book in a way.
Huh.
It's not just a satire. It's different from other book. It's a fable. So there is some kind of a timeless quality in this book.
We're going to be talking specifically about children's literature a little later. But I wanted to ask you, have you read books by writers from former communist countries who might have a special insight into democracy today?
Yes, there are conventionally, we do have Zamatin's We. That's a book in the similar to 1984.
That's a
science fiction in a way, but nowadays it's slightly old-fashioned, I would say. Also, there's a book by Arthur Kettler, Darkness at Noon, about the prison life in the totalitarian regime. Mm. So yes, there are this kind of literary works. But nowadays, I think, obviously, totalitarian regimes are really are falling down everywhere, including China, falling down slowly. So in that sense, somehow literature should be more subtle than that. I think that also explains why Animal Farm is really different from the other books in that anti-utopian tradition.
Hajin, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, sir.
Hajin, a professor of English and creative writing at Boston University, the author of Waiting and The Crazed. That book, by the way, comes out in paperback in January. He was with us from his office in Boston, Massachusetts. And let's get a caller on the line. This is Ken, who's with us from San Francisco.
Well, hello there, Neil.
Hello.
Glad to be on your show.
Thanks.
I would like to suggest Cicero's Oration.
Cicero, the great Roman orator. And
that's correct. I have several reasons, not the least of which is that, of course, the slogan of the Roman Empire was Senatus Populesque Romanum, which implies, as Cicero did in all of his orations, that the people are the fundament of power.
I've not read Cicero's orations. I have to confess to that. What moves you particularly about them?
Well, in the Catilinarian conspiracy in particular, he points up the failings of the oligarchy, and his appeal is made to the people.
Okay. Well, we'll add Cicero then to the classic section of our Library of Democracy. Thanks very much for the suggestion, Ken.
Well, thank you, Neil.
Okay. We have more emails, of course. Baton Rouge, Louisiana, Jack Harrison. To any Library of Democracy, I would add, alongside his classic Grapes of Wrath, John Steinbeck's Travels with Charlie. What are your ideas to fill the shelves of the Library of Democracy? 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or email us, totn@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan, back in a minute. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're building a library of democracy today, shelf by shelf, from the works of Aristotle to Huckleberry Finn. We're talking about the books that have helped us understand what democracy is and how it might work a little bit better. What book would you add to the library? You're invited to join the discussion. Our phone number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, and the email address is totn@npr.org. And let's go now to Leif, who's with us from San Antonio, Texas.
Hi.
Hi.
Actually, it's pronounced Leif.
Oh, excuse me. I'm sorry.
That's all right. The book that I would add would be Ezra Pound's book from the early 1950s, The True Believer.
And why that one?
It's a book about fanaticism, and the founders of this nation were very concerned about one of the dangers of democracy being subject to demagogues.
Pound had some experience with that.
Pound does have some experience with that, and that's why I think his book is still very, very relevant even today. The demagoguery may be one of the great dangers of democracy.
Leif, thanks very much for joining us. Did I get it right that time?
I'm sorry?
Did I get it right that time?
Yes, you did.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Leif, thanks very much for calling, and we appreciate it. Here's some more emails on literature. You need a counterexample in this case to determine how far you have moved from democracy to totalitarianism. This is especially true since our view of ourselves as a democratic country is influenced as much by our beliefs as by reality. I would not leave out George Orwell's 1984 from any library of democracy. That from Tom Blakely in Jacksonville, Florida. I'd inadvertently added it earlier, so now it's officially in the Library of Democracy. Huxley's Brave New World, says Bruce Kanagaki from San Antonio. This book serves as a caution in the extreme as to what sort of society might arise when personal liberties that are the inherent virtues of a democratic society are denied to the individual citizen. Well, one place you would probably not go immediately to look for books on democracy is the children's section. Eden Lipson is the children's book editor for the New York Times. She says children's stories are often an allegory for sophisticated concepts like democracy. She's with us now from our bureau in New York. Eden, always good to have you on the program.
Hi, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thank you. What role has children's books played in explaining the idea of democracy?
Well, I think we should back off a second and talk about where democracy begins, and isn't it, after all, on the playground and in the schoolyard? And isn't that where we learn how to treat other people and how we want to be treated? And isn't that behavior reinforced at home at night before you go to bed in the stories that you read and the things that you talk to your parents about? And while the shelf that's being built by your participants and callers is one that's directed to adults, there's also a way of talking to really little children about the modes of behavior that underlie everything we think about democracy. And I decided not to put forth names of books that you read on your own, but rather the ones that you read when you're sitting in someone's lap and they're read to you. And I looked at a cluster going back a half a century and one that's brand new this fall. So let me just give you some titles, and you'll remember a lot of them.
Mm-hmm.
There's Frog and Toad Are Friends, a wonderful series of early readers about being nice to each other and cooperating and taking care of each other. Amos and Boris, one of the great books about friendship by William Steig, A Mouse and a Whale, but about different being different and friends. Molly's Pilgrim by Barbara Cohen, the wonderful story about the little immigrant girl who is supposed to bring a doll to the third grade Thanksgiving celebration, and her pilgrim doesn't look like anybody else's pilgrim.
Hmm.
The Arabulis of Liberty Street, Sam Swope's wonderful allegory about when the Arabulis hit Liberty Street and the mean general who wanted everything to be the same. Kathy Jacobson's wonderfully illustrated version of This Land Is Your Land, the Woody Guthrie song, that goes all across the country and all across modern history. And then right now, there's a new book out that I'm just enchanted by called Two Eggs, Please. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like it's about democracy.
Or breakfast, one or the other.
So a mouse walks into a diner and says, two eggs, please. A series of animals come into a diner and they all order two eggs. But they order them sunny side up and over easy and scrambled and soft boiled and hard boiled and on a roll and poached and raw. And the eggs are the same and they're different. and the animals who order them are different, but they order the same thing. And I think that can really be seen as a way of talking about the broadest notions of democracy and cooperation.
We have some suggestions from listeners, as you might suspect.
I'll bet.
Scott Condry in Portland, Oregon suggests T.H. White's The Once and Future King, a great book not only for understanding democracy, but many other different forms of governments. Merlin changes the young Arthur into different animals to let him experience different ways to govern his people. Of course, he was doing that in a monarchy, which is a little bit different than a democracy, but nevertheless, it's a wonderful book. We'll be glad to add it. Peter in Cleveland suggests Richard Scarry's Busy Town books for offering equality amongst all occupations and walks of life. A truck driver, a town constable, and a librarian are all looked upon with the same sense of wonder, he says. And here's some from books I'm not familiar with. After folks have studied the basics, writes Michael Field in Gambier, Ohio, here are two books I would recommend to give balance. Oliver Wiswell by Kenneth Roberts, a historical novel about the American Revolution from the Loyalist side, the North Americans that did not believe in violent separation from Britain, and Gordon the Goat by Monroe Leaf, a children's book about the perils of following the crowd. Do you know those?
Well, Oliver Wiswell, I do. I don't know the Monroe Leaf.
Okay, and here's one from Benjamin C. Kids' book, Fish is Fish, about the limits of understanding. And in our kids' entertainment video section, suggested by a Spanish teacher at Holmes Junior High School, Leanna Neely, everything I learned about democracy in the U.S. government, I learned from Schoolhouse Rock. Well, that's going a little bit further afield, Eden, than we thought. Let's take a caller. Polly joins us on the line from Wakeman, Ohio.
Hello. Sometimes we spoon-fed kids, and my father discovered a book a while ago called Patrol by Walter Dean Myers. Myers is normally a young adult writer, but he has now done a picture book with Anne Griffelcone, I think is her name.
Griffelcone.
Oh, thank you.
Easy for you to say.
And it's exactly.
It's an amazing book.
It is totally amazing and so important for children and families to be looking at right now. We are individuals in a democracy, and we need to make our choices.
Well, maybe we should explain that what it is the narrative of an attack on a military patrol in Vietnam, and the central character is a black American soldier. And it's a very haunting and beautifully illustrated and an upsetting book. I think it works best with children in middle school, where you can really talk about the specifics of the history of that war and what's going on in that particular jungle.
Well, perhaps in the school setting, but in the family setting, when families do understand the Vietnam War and are involved now in discussions about this war, it certainly works very well in a family intimate setting.
Sure.
For any age.
But I would wonder about under school age, but I would defer to your family.
My father's professor of children's literature from the University of Wisconsin, and he would have no qualms in the proper intimate setting. There are many families who discuss these issues with young children, and they are indeed just as easily understood if they're presented with that kind of love and affection and the knowledge that children of all ages are individuals.
Thanks for the suggestion, Polly.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. And Eden Ross Lipson, one final thought. That's obviously a book that's more directly about an experience. We were talking earlier about analogies like Animal Farm. Is one to be preferred over the other?
You have 365 nights a year.
And a good rocking chair.
And a good rocking chair.
Eden Lipson, thanks very much as always.
Thanks, Neil.
Eden Lipson is children's book editor of the New York Times and author of the New York Times Parents Guide to the Best Books for Children. She was with us from our bureau in New York. And let's get another caller on the line. Susan's with us from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, this is a great idea. I'd like to suggest Fahrenheit 451.
Ray Bradbury, yes.
And also A Day in the Life of Ivan Denisovich.
Which was about the gulag.
Yes.
Now, Fahrenheit 451, of course, a book about censorship and book burning. Is that why you think it's important?
Yes. The alternatives to democracy or to free thinking.
Okay, thanks very much.
And Lisa Strada.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Let's go to Linda, and Linda's on the line with us from Wiesbaden, Germany.
Hi, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
I'd like to suggest the autobiography of Benjamin Franklin for a couple of reasons. I would think it would be accessible to young adults because, as Benjamin Franklin talks about his own growing up and his trials and tribulations, you see indirectly how he learns to interact with friends and with local societies and communities and how to create democracy, in a sense, on a local level. And another reason is, in a sense, how religion can play a role in democracy or not. In when people talk about the Founding Fathers and democracy, they think Christian and organized religion, and you see from Benjamin Franklin's point of view, a deist point of view, where it's not so much organized religion, but religious principles.
Well, thanks for the thought. We'll be happy to add Benjamin Franklin to the Library of Democracy.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. The lessons of history are invaluable to understanding any concept, and here to help us fill up the historical section of our Library of Democracy is Orlando Patterson, a historical sociologist and professor at Harvard University, also the author of Freedom and the Making of Western Culture. The book won the National Book Award in 1991. He's with us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts, and welcome to Talk of the Nation. Professor Patterson?
Hello there.
Hi, welcome to Talk of the Nation.
Thank you for having me.
What books do you think need to be on the history shelf?
Well, democracy was really first fully constructed in ancient Greece. There may have been precursors, but I think it's generally agreed that the Greeks first fully developed it, first systematically thought about it. And what's fascinating wasn't just that fact of being the first, but the circumstances under which it emerged. And the book I think which I would recommend most is by Moses Finley, M.I. Finley, Democracy, Ancient and Modern. Finley himself is a fascinating man. He was very much a Democrat and got himself in trouble with McCarthy, sort of had to flee the country, eventually became master of Darwin College in Cambridge, is one of the great classicists. He writes beautifully. He has a great merit of being able to do something which American historians and writers generally seem to have lost the art of doing, which is to write concise books. He really wrote books over 200 pages, and but very, very beautifully distilled. So Democracy, Ancient and Modern, it's certainly my first choice because it not only sort of analyzes with extraordinary grace and insight this first democracy, but has a lot to tell us about our world today in the sense that he draws parallels throughout with modern democracy. He emphasizes the fact that democracy involves participation among the Greeks, that the assembly was paramount there, that the idea prevailed that democracy was not just a means to an end, but the good society itself in operation. And these are all lessons we could learn today. There's also a sort of really fascinating discussion in one of these essays on democracy, consensus, and the national interest. What is meant by the national interest? And there, he discusses the Peloponnesian Wars and the debate over just in whose interest were these wars being fought, and for the people or for the elites or what? And a debate which, of course, is sort of pertinent today, but Finley also came up with some very interesting sort of explanations of the reason why democracy first emerged in ancient Greece. One of the great paradoxes of ancient Greece is that for this first great democracy emerged in what is a large-scale slave society, very similar to the slave society we had in the Old South, certainly proportionately about the same size, the proportion of slaves, about a third of the population, and so on. So the paradox there is, how could democracy have emerged under these circumstances? And the answer, surprisingly, is that it wasn't accidental. it may have been there may have been a direct relationship between the two, that democracy entailed a sort of bond of solidarity between one group who constitute the demos, the electorate, the citizens, vis-a-vis an internal domestic enemy who were the slaves.
We're speaking with Professor Orlando Patterson of Harvard University as we construct our library of democracy. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And Professor Patterson, I didn't mean to cut you off there, but we also have a correction that a listener has called in. A caller misidentified the author of The True Believer. It was not Ezra Pound. It was the famous longshoreman philosopher Eric Hoffer. So I wanted to make sure we got that in. You were talking about the analogies between the slave societies in Greece and, of course, in this country when democracy was established here. And I'm sorry to cut you off.
Let's fast forward to my next choice, which is Edmund S. Morgan's wonderful, seminal historical study, American Slavery, American Freedom, The Ordeal of Colonial Virginia. And again, Morgan's objective is to explain the paradox that the really first democratic system in America occurred in Virginia. That's where, in fact, male, in that case white male citizens, first voted in great numbers. All males could vote who were free. And he was motivated to explain the paradox that that democracy thrived in what was then a large-scale slave society. And the question was why? And the answer in many ways is the same as ancient Greece, which is that you had emerging a contradistinctive bond between those who were free, in this case white, and male, as opposed to those who were unfree and female or black. And so this idea that there's a contradistinctive bond, an exclusive inclusiveness, which encouraged strong sense of solidarity and encouraged the demos, is one of the great paradoxes of our past and of this thing we call democracy, which, while it's a wonderful thing, often you know, out of the evil often cometh good, and it seems that democracy is one of these good things that emerged out of a rather evil context.
Orlando Patterson, thank you very much for being with us today. Two good suggestions. Orlando Patterson, professor of sociology at Harvard University, the author of Freedom and the Making of Western Culture, which won the 1991 National Book Award. We might want to sneak that into the Library of Democracy as well. He joined us from his office in Cambridge, Massachusetts. We've heard from Governor Mario Cuomo and children's book editor Eden Lipson about the books they would contribute. Ray Kurzweil, the futurist, when we come back from a short break. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, as part of Public Radio's week-long coverage, Whose Democracy Is It?, we're building a library of democracy with your help. Here's some emails we've gotten. Tom Santoni in Hastings, Florida, suggests a people's history of the United States by Howard Zinn. He says it's a must for the Democracy Library as an illustration of what democracy is not, and what it could be. Also, Eileen Ording suggests How the Scots Invented the Modern World by Arthur Herman. Many of the founding fathers were descended from Scottish immigrants or trained by Scots. Scotland's story is prehistory of American democracy. She writes to us from Ohio. And let's get a caller on the line. Charles is with us from Mystic, Connecticut.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a suggestion for you. It's going to sound dull, but I would argue that it isn't. And it's Robert's Rules of Order.
Ah, how to conduct yourself in a big meeting, basically.
Yeah, even as big a meeting as an entire country. I mean, the book really turns out to be a kind of how-to on democracy. Can I read you one sentence from the preface to it?
Please go ahead.
The application of parliamentary law is the best method yet devised to enable assemblies of any size, with due regard for every member's opinion, to arrive at the general will on the maximum number of questions of varying complexity in a minimum amount of time and under all kinds of internal climate ranging from total harmony to hardened or impassioned division of opinion.
Charles, we're delighted to add Robert's Rules of Orders to the Library of Democracy. Thanks very much.
Sure.
There are many more sections in a library than we could fill because we only have time for one more, really. Joining us now to help start off our science section is Ray Kurzweil. He's CEO of Kurzweil Technologies Incorporated and author of The Age of Spiritual Machines. He's with us now from Boston, Massachusetts, and it's good of you to be with us today.
Glad to join you.
So where do you see the ideas of science intersect with the idea of democracy?
Well, if you consider what is democracy, it's a form of group decision-making within a community, and technology is affecting us in several ways. First of all, it's creating new communities. Distributed communication technologies are creating communities not just based on geographic boundaries, but on shared interests and values that may cross continents. And they're also transforming discourse within existing ones, creating the ability to share ideas very, very quickly. And we're seeing the impact already on this election.
Mm-hmm. Certainly in terms of the Internet. But what books in particular would you suggest for our library, and why?
Well, the principal one I would recommend is SMART. It's M-O-B-S, which actually has two pronunciations, MOBS, as in mobile communication devices, and MOBS, as in people that spontaneously organize.
Flash mobs.
Right. SMART mobs, the next social revolution, transforming cultures and communities in the age of instant access by Howard Rheingold. And he, first of all, describes many entertaining ways in which new communities emerge, particularly from distributed wireless communication. For example, teenage cliques that hang out electronically rather than in front of the local drugstore. How wireless communication is allowing spontaneous demonstrations to be organized. It's, for example, World Economic Conferences. Amusing examples such as services that enable your cell phone to play a distinctive song when you're within range of someone matching your romantic profile. The recent trend of random mobs where people spontaneously get together through spontaneous Internet communication where suddenly a mob will appear in, say, Penn Station. Everyone's flapping their hands up and down or just doing something silly. And, of course, recent examples, Howard Dean has used the Internet for fundraising and emerged without, having a national name recognition initially, has emerged as the leading fundraiser. And President Bush has also used the Internet to good effect, raising more money than the Democratic candidates
put together. Yeah, obviously we're talking about books, so I guess the first and technology of this, I guess, is the printing press, and we go back to Gutenberg. But would you have any other ideas?
Well, I really use this as a stepping stone to talk about the democratizing power of decentralized electronic communication. I mean, we really first saw that in the fall of the Soviet Union. I actually wrote in the mid-1980s that they had a choice to either give their professionals these very powerful communication tools, which were much more powerful than the copiers they had traditionally banned, which would destroy their totalitarian control of information, or they could ban the technologies, which would destroy their economy. And in the end, they did a little bit of both, and both did them in. So when there was that coup against Gorbachev in 1991, it wasn't overturned by Yeltsin bravely standing on a tank. It was really the clandestine network of decentralized communication, fax machines, early forms of email using teletype machines. So the authorities were unable to just seize the centralized radio and television stations as they had done in the past to keep the people in the dark. And I think similarly, you can trace the whole movement towards political democracy in much of the world through the 1990s to this advent of unfettered communication, particularly through the Internet, but through all the varied forms of decentralized communication that are not centralized, that allow spontaneous communication of ideas across people that have that share ideas. And we see that really at other levels other than the political level. For example, patients with a chronic condition will develop their own Internet-based communities, and as a result, they'll go into their doctor's office armed with a great deal of knowledge and information, so the doctor is no longer the sole source of all knowledge about that particular condition. So it's really democratizing relationships at many different levels of society.
Ray Kurzweil, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
Two wonderful contributions to the Library of Democracy. Ray Kurzweil is the CEO of Kurzweil Technologies Incorporated, the author of The Age of Spiritual Machines. That was the book that he referred to as he was speaking. He was joining us from Boston, Massachusetts. And let's get some callers in. This is Tom, who's with us from Sioux City, Iowa.
Oh, good afternoon, Neil. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
Great. My contribution to the library would be what I think is the definitive work about how American politics works, and that's the Making of the Presidency, 1960, by Theodore H. White, talking about the Nixon-Kennedy race of 60. And it's, for those that haven't read it, I don't see how you could begin to understand what American politics are all about until you've at least brushed by that book.
And maybe come to the conclusion that maybe politics and democracy are not quite the same thing.
Yes, that's right. But it understands how. Yes, that's right. But it paints the picture of democracy in sometimes flattering and sometimes majestic ways, and other times unflattering.
Okay, Tom. Thanks very much.
Thank you very much.
Bye bye. Here's a couple of science emails that we got while we were speaking with Ray Kurzweil. The Origin of Species by Charles Darwin. That's a suggestion from Rod Aguirre. And from Don Gibson in Oro Valley, Arizona, Norbert Wiener's Cybernetics and Society, subtitled The Human Use of Human Beings. So there you go. Let's go to Luke. And Luke is with us from Portland, Oregon.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. I'm so happy to recommend this neglected classic set of books. I don't know if I've ever heard anyone discuss it, and a local history professor isn't even aware of it. It's called The Annals of America, and it's published by Encyclopedia Britannica. It's been around for about 30 years, but now they've updated it. It goes from 1492 to 1985, about. It's 20 volumes in chronological order of classic and forgotten writings throughout American history. I'll recommend Volume 2 for your show, which is on the 20 years from 1765 to about 1785. The Revolutionary, that volume is on those revolutionary 20 years where the shot heard round the world, a king was rejected, and world history began to be changed at that point. And that volume is just a flame of democracy right there.
We've got a big budget here at the Library of Democracy, so guess what, Luke? We're going to get all the volumes.
Oh, 20 volumes. I'm telling you, you've got to check into it. It is awesome. It's scholarly little introductions to each selection of, you know, these are source documents throughout American history. It is incredible. It's fantastic, and with introductions, and it's even got illustrations from each period, you know, etchings from each volume covers about 10 years as you move along. The first volumes, of course, sweep in a little extra, but it's just rich. It's got everything from personal diaries to classic political writings to poems to it is Americana.
Well, thanks very much.
Yeah, Volume 2 is The Revolution.
We'll keep that in mind when we skip ahead and have to look for a cheat sheet on the revolution question on the quiz. Luke, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News.